expect a lot of you. I thought I'd read you some stories, some prose, that is. All this audience was responsible. And some poetry. I suppose, and then perhaps you'll have a break in the middle. I mean, that's my thought. Perhaps I'll do about an hour at the most, if that's all right. And, you know, oh, 10 minutes in the middle. Really good. Grab some more wine. Are they supposed to drink the wine or what? Throughout the reading could be heard the sound of a till jingling. Well, I'm going to read you some newish ones because I suppose I'm more interested in them. Though I should, you know, just do myself a favour and save them to the end. So I'll just read you through this. Blank pages. So I'm down now. These weren't ones, the little short ones I wrote for a while. I was in Colorado earlier this year, teaching at the Naropa Institute. So then one day we went up in the mountains and had to write instant poems. You see, that was this exercise for the workshop. So this is what I did. Upturned seabed with a cloud hat, flat iron. Old hurrying river shakes the mountain's bones. Roosevelt National Forest, spray-painted spring foliage against utility evergreens. If trees were people, it would be crowded up here. May storm, spruce pine and a cold wet mountain, snow thick as a fur coat wraps over treetops, embracing the peak. It's very close to Rocky Flats, which is where they have the plutonium bomb factory, where they manufacture the triggers for nuclear weapons. Each trigger is like the equivalent of one of the bombs that went off from the inside. Rocky Flats supermarket special offer, tinned plutonium soup. It's because they have this the supermarkets have this generic food. Have you seen it? We've got it here now. It's like in London anyway. Some of this just yellow tins, just yellow packing with no fancy labelling, black letters. Have you seen it?
Sainsbury's
doing it. Yeah, what they're putting in there. And as it was a kind of religious establishment which I was teaching, I wrote ideological friendship. Never ask the same guru two questions. To be on the safe side, that is. Hare Krishna, disciple, said, "We wear this mud on our forehead for the same reason policemen have helmets." I don't know what he meant. But it was Hare Krishna doing Regent's Park, in Hyde Park this summer. Going around, their heads plastered with mud. Right, so this is a rather in Poland last December. Domestic art on a white cabinet in our three blue bathroom. She has folded over a glass dish of abalone shells a bright pink face cloth, and also. And I thought that was called domestic art, so I thought I'd write a whole series of poems. I mean, I lived most of the time in Poland, or a lot of the time in Warsaw, and I find myself writing a particular kind of poem, seems to be. In Poland. This is another one of those. I got a review once, more than once, but one of these reviews I got, excuse me. Take off my shirt and get carried away. Till later. If I use a joint office. In which it said there was something about ingenuousness, so checked it in a dictionary. In search of ingenuousness. And it's absolutely true. Opening a dictionary between inflict and inhuman. My eye falls on a flower placed there and preserved by you. Seeing it informs my heart and folds. Between idolize and ILO, a violet whose moth petals hover on ignotum per ignotius, explanation obscures the object. Started using all these Latin since I came to this university. I mean, I was my tone's considerably. Right, so I keep writing these poems in Poland, local weather. I live quite close to the. In fact, our house, live in a little cul-de-sac, and on one side is the central cathedral. One side of this. Cul-de-sac, and next to it is a police station. KGB guy was over there, and there's a little vestry there. And it's an incredible place, actually. So, local weather, maybe I should call it Polish weather. That sudden rumbling of a sheeted tin, trembling as it's hoisted over wooden scaffolding to the vestry rooftop. Radio. So I spent a lot of time listening to the World Service, actually various World Services, to the Russian World Service in English, and the English World Service in English, and the Voice of America in, quote, special English. It's amazing, I mean.
This is the Voice of America broadcasting in special English.
I thought they meant it was lies. You know, it was special English in the lines. They just made it slow, but they were like, first language, it was not. And even the Swedish, I don't know, I just get good reception in Warsaw, whether you can get them here or not. Yeah, all the Swedish, the French, and even the Albanian world service, that's the really Stalinist. It's unbelievable. So this is radio. Its timing is perfect and variable. Its pronunciation impeccable. Its information unblemished. Its sources faultless. Its correspondence infallible. Its contents uncontaminated. Its motives are pure. It has many voices. Real estate. Some carpenter are hammering on the roof of one of God's many houses, replacing tiles or just keeping a tight lid on a soft ceiling in preparation for a rough winter. And of course, they're getting a very rough winter. So, how are we doing? This is, this is called, it might be unfinished actually. But I'll read it anyway. Called Whirl.
Whirl?
Whirl. It's called Whirl. I was going to call it. Actually, I had to call it Whirl because the last line was going to be the dead and with it whirl. But I thought it was too, I couldn't, you know, do all this alliteration and everything. So I put it in the title. There are women, so it's Warsaw in September. There are women selling flowers on the streets, holding up tall bunches which are kissing off their long blessed kit in signal colours, or clutching tight nestling bouquets.
It is the gladioli season, and Duana selects those rarely hued with tight hoods, avoiding blood red, but when given those as gifts, quickly re-gives to fresh guests. Those remaining, she daily cuts frayed inches from their otherwise taut stalks, and plucks into her palm with three fingers and the heel of a thumb the dead and withered calyxes.
So, he was still more so.
Okay, the perfect woman. This is a Warsaw poem. The perfect woman stands simultaneously in five different queues while cleaning the home and making stews. They do actually. So we spend a lot of time with queues, and people you learn the art of queuing, which is not too bad in the summer. But I think people will actually die in queues this winter. But you can stand in, you know, two queues at once at least, because you ask the person in front of you always, not the person behind you, to remember that you were there. And then so you go off and do the same in another queue, you know, so jump between the two or three, as a perfect woman does. Never mind. I started writing the thoughts of Chairman Q. There's always a queue within the queue, and the person behind is always too close, and stick to the person in front. Radio. My radio interprets the past, manages the present, and programs the future. My radio makes truth sound false. My radio is in complete control and cannot be questioned. Here's one more Polish poem, which is called My Pen. So I find myself, and I quite like it, I must say. And the radio, incidentally, I mean, I'm not specifically talking about finding any radio. I just get shocked at the bias of all media, particularly American, but coming back to England, it's very evident the way, for instance, the media systematically is dismantling the Labour Party. This is My Pen. The last Polish poem. And Dom Książki means bookshop, right? It's literally House of Books, Dom Książki. Nowy Świat is a street, and it means New World. My Pen. My pen holds steady in my right hand, black with a silver top and tight golden nib. My hero pen, made in the People's Republic of China and purchased in Warsaw by my wild, cloud-haired Polish wife with apple-green eyes and 20 faces. My pen makes tight scrawls, regular designs and footnotes joining vertical strokes to curved and looping horizontals. My pen clips easily into a pocket, sucks noisy and quick when dipped in black Indian ink. My pen speaks volumes, running its incised beak along prescribed lines. My pen feels comfortable, poised between finger and thumb. My pen pours out centuries of industry and sweat. My ebony black, silver-topped, golden star 705 Chinese pen looks good with a blue and chrome 371 Yan Chang made in Shanghai, China, best quality swivel type stapler with four different uses. My pen writes adverts for its comrades. My pen shouldn't get too smart.
My pen was purchased near Dom Kshansky and Novosvet, where walls of books are dripping ink and threaten to flood whole streets. My pen refuses to pay nib service to obsolete forms of government. My pen's ink is a distilled dream of 50,000 million workers weary with clocking in and clocking out, signing on and signing off, enslaved to machinery of industry and state. My pen votes with its feet. My pen insists it knows best and wants to manage its own affairs. My pen demands complete autonomy. Right. Don't have a crush now. So one of the poems in this half, and then there's a couple of stories in the second half, which you'll be sick of the part of 25 times already. But it's, the stories are great on this side, really fun on this side. So don't run away in the end of it. But I'm buying the book anyway. Which are on sale in front of me. In the bargain pack. My mother's Christmas presents. Tranquilizer, that's it. Strange time for a poem. No, no, travel. I thought I had a poem, I didn't even know I'd read. Philosophy, if you don't like what he says, just look at the pictures. Television, I should call it. Right, so, maybe I'll read. This is a kind of shambling sort of reading, isn't it? This is, are any of you familiar with the photographs of Bill Brandt? Yeah? You? No? Well, he's a really interesting photographer in the 30s, and he's still alive. I think there's something retrospective exhibition with him, which he'd be going around, isn't it? And he took some pictures which were very, made, you know, shocked a lot of people in the 30s, and that social media pictures of the socially, I mean, obliterated areas, the capitalist disaster areas, like Tyneside. And one of the pictures is of people scrapping about on pit heaps, looking for, pushing bicycles and all that, scrapping excellent for the pit, scrapping on slag heaps for little tiny bits of coal, small bits of coal. So something I saw on the banks of the River Tyne reminded me of those photographs. And this was a couple of years ago. So it's called A Sense of History. Along the banks of the Tyne, to look for driftwood, dawn mist over water, the great stone railway bridge with blackened arches. A couple, pensioners bent and stiff, scrape the dry earth with wire sticks. They hacked at hard cloths, collecting small bits of coal, dust almost, baked in frozen mud and clay. This is in America. I've got a poem. Do you mind if I just count myself with this? No objections. Is anybody else on the top of them?
I'll pay the order after.
Okay. So I've got a poem called Marta, which I might read. I mean, it's part of the longer poem, which I might read there. But this, when I read it in America, I met this guy, and he told me it was someone somewhat similar. So maybe it was just a kind of verbatim. A New Jersey legend. Not really New Jersey, no. New Jersey. Joe Lewis told me a fancy patsy who shat in his pants and chased after buses yelling, "Hey, Pinky!" His mother, wiping his arse, slapped him in a suit and took him to a club called The Edge, where he played fantastic piano and made good money until he got off the stool and started shitting around again. "Hey, Pinky!" It's true, it's true. Cast off, crouched over, and and a Bowery doorway, and no coat's forgotten, no one wears it anymore.
Let's think about that.
But not that one. The Valentine's so soft lips amid sky-kissed buildings be mine. In America, the medicine looked so good, I wanted to get ill and try it. Buffalo, every bastard I ever met was beautiful.
Right. What I'm going to do is read you. I should really read from your book, you see, to encourage you to sort of buy one of them.
But I might use the newest one first. I'm going to read a couple. Oh yeah, I read, this is two letters from a white girl in Brixton. Or that's a subtitle actually. The new, have we got a piece of chalk?
We've got a blackboard.
We used to have a blackboard. Is any black chalk? Well, this is called, should be called the Scarman Report. S-K-A. Scarman Report. And literally what it is. Was I received two letters from a girl living in Brixton. One before the police riot and one after the police riot. And I was teaching Resnikov's poetry. So I thought, you know, well, look, we've got these letters. I just banged them and battered them and I dropped one word here and broke them as I feel. And edited them a little bit. And made these two fan poems out of it, which are called Scarman Report. And, you know, it was after the first Brixton riot, which was in March, wasn't it? April, 1981. And I mean, I'd heard from my own daughter, who's 14 and got a son in 18, and they applied for a job. Oh, they were, one of our friends had tried to join a sweet factory and there was one vacancy, I think there was 400 applicants. So I thought, well, and I learned two letters. Scarman Report. I'm living in Britain, it's a date, right? March 3rd, 17th, 1981. I'm living in Brixton now, in a squat on the infamous Drug Lane. It's got hot water plus electric. I'm trying to find a job, which is virtually impossible, and doing my A-level evening classes. Most of my spare time is spent in pubs and at gigs, when we've got the money, which is rare, because the dole is only 1950 a week. There's a huge rally for the unemployed in Hyde Park next month, with a load of good groups, UB40, Specials, The Beat, Misty, lots of reggae and ska. In Brixton, there's always a blues going on, full of rasters and spliffs. Great. April 14th, 1981. None of the papers have got any truth. On Friday, this bloke got stabbed, so some rasters phones an ambulance. While they were waiting, the cops turned up and grabbed the guy to question him. They dumped him in the back of the squad car and kept him bleeding for 20 minutes. Eventually, his friends dragged him away to take him to the hospital, and the cops turns to tries to do him and a few others for resisting arrest. On Saturday, there were loads of cops on the beat and five or six bands of SPG patrolling. What provoked all the trouble was really some undercover cops who, after the police stopped a van and searched it, started yelling and waving cautious. The next thing was these black blokes pushed the police van over and set it on fire. I saw this just as I turned the corner. Then loads of cops with riot shields turned up and tried to cordon off the area, but crowds of blacks, gays and punks showered them with bricks and bottles. Most of the reporters had their cameras smashed, but they let me take pictures. One rasta lives down the road was saying, "Take pictures of the opposition." So I took one of six cops dragging a 15-year-old kid up the street and trying to bundle him into a van. His mother was saying, "Let him walk," but they wouldn't. One cop whacked him round the face, so I said, "Oh, don't do that." And another said, "We've got to have our fun." Then everyone was saying, let's burn down the George, which is this totally prejudiced pub next door. Crates of gin and beer were brought out and passed around the crowd, black and white. This Rasta was saying, don't get drunk. And another bloke collected all the bottles into a pile and started making Molotov cocktails with petrol from one of many cars that were later burned. Then the looting carried on up the road and into Brixton, where most of the jewellery shops, Woolworths and some clothes shops got looted and burned. Sunday was mostly people from outside, tourists who read in the paper and came to look. There were 20 vans and 10 coaches of police and helicopters flying about, so nothing could really happen. I saw loads of fire engines and cops up by the prison. At one point, they cordoned off Railton Road at both ends, so some Rastas moved loads of instruments and mics into the street and started jamming. Soon, a street party was going on. One bloke was telling the cops to join in and saying, black and white together, unite and fight, etc. After about half an hour, the rioting started again. I got a few cuts and bruises.
Right, so I'm going to read you a poem called, title poem in the book called Here and There. And then a short poem, and then I will think. And 10 minutes. And there is 35 tea bottles in one.
This is called Herodust, and I don't really know what it's about. It begins with a short poem of Robert Creeley. It's a very short poem, but it's only one line. He forgot he'd read it. You know, I saw him in Buffalo. It was really great. I wish I hadn't told him. I was only going to thing, not that I know. Can you get on top of me? Or from me?
Excuse me, I've got a sore throat actually.
Thank you. Hero Dust. Love is, Creeley's poem. Love is the highway to the door. End of Creeley poem. Saw the gypsy lady, told me all bad news, said I'm going on a journey to the land of the blues. Saw the gypsy lady, said cross my palm with blood. I'll tell you about your future and it don't look good. An Aztec tunnel under the new urban motorway. Full moon above the Victorian working class houses. A doll's arm and a partly demolished terraces. Rusted wheels, cast iron cogs, chains poised taut, abandoned to rain, to sleet, the memory of trimmers. A southern vessel nudges wooden stairs. Awaits truck shunted and unbuckled by demons, moss mottled with oil and slime, bedding for skeletons of scuttled boats, collapsed jetties. Played dominoes tonight, threw down the wrong one and won. Through the chin and got grace, but embarrassed Confucius, I'm confused. He threw me a glance on the roads, talked of riding through woods on a bike. Sent me a postcard of a Russian sun god and a peasant girl in ferns. A maze of streets and back lanes, 4 in the morning, walking. Cities reach unbroken to the sea. Men climb ladders, descend pits, erect scaffolding, demolish buildings, devise plans, revise maps. Sun streams through birch, spokes of your wheels alight. A cat howls, I dream of you. A gypsy surrounded by bairns, she asks me for fuck, we are overlooked. This street is built with bricks of furrowed brows, whole gutters explode and tremble with sparrows. You may not find me kind, love has no hold on me, hold me. To taste your lips, I won't smoke for a month. At 13, I failed to become a complete teddy boy, owing to my mother's dark memories of Mosley Mom. She did not buy me a black shirt. Fingers through forests, you come. A flower shakes off its pollen. Each leg trembles. It's cold, I crawl up and curl on you. This is the fifth night without sleep, I'm bruised with love. Rats are chipping at the skirting board, birds are singing. It's dawn, I had to write a poem. Hello, pain, we meet again, lovely as before and strange. Hello, sorrow, and the need to borrow bliss, my lips lit with your first kiss. Why, joy, am I your boy, your latest toy? Play any game, choose the hardest pitch. Dance on pain, keep sorrow in the ditch. I'm fierce, I'm furious, my fury flames furnaces, my fire flights hawks, my savage smiles ravage hyenas, my dreams devise daggers, demand death, my lascivious laughter. Oh, insulas, flush with stolen roses. Barefoot and broken glass, shattered mirror, this side of reflection, chandeliers explode, walls become walls, within walls. Follow this maze, this way out, is that way in, withershins, the direction contrary to the course of the sun. Your beak breaks the flesh of my breast, I scream, tormented by dreams. Moon full of the sea, what waves there are, what tide. Your eyes wide as a mother's thigh. A hot animal lies beneath my hand, her rib takes the weight of my fingers. She wears her scar like a jewel. I hear her whining the wheels of a diesel, her body the aroma of nipped buds. An unlit boiler house road, an astronaut and a moped passed me. I hid in Reservation Street. You're lost in the maze of the dying culture. She too joined the cavalry. I replied, the guys in your betraying eyes. I have saved the bird in my breast. Death's eye smiles with the mouth of a flower. I'm going to finish with this poem, which I wrote. I suppose it would be like a domestic art series. But I wrote it in America, thinking about I was in this Buddhist institute. And it was very passive. Somebody come in? Come. Thanks, man. No, that's really good. So, it's called Recipe. As I said, I'll read a story, I suppose, about us drunk and binge on a Polish train traveling across, Russian train traveling across the port with 15 different accents. Recipe. Be mean with an onion. Rip off its dry skin and grip well. Slice across its spear and chop. The onion will rise into your eyes. The onion will rise into your nostrils and speak to your eyes. Keep slicing, leap and toss into a hot iron pot with chicken pieces, rib tickling each with bay leaves. Use what herbs there are to hand, allspice, chili, cloves, and yogurt. Decorate with saffron, sliced peel from a fresh lemon. Poke with a fork, and don't let spitting fat put you off. Fight back. So if you have a 10-minute break. You didn't get much of your money, did you? Right, this is a story that takes place traveling on a Russian train in a Russian sleeping compartment to the Russian train, 1976, maybe it was a time and place. Going across Poland, having traveled a few days. And they're about, you know, about that now, and there's two bunks, they're quite luxurious actually. I mean, just skinny and that. They don't take up much room. But they are quite narrow. This picks up the story on the second day of it. And you've got to forgive the accents. Because there's a few of them. Right, so head out the window and the sun shines and away. There's nothing to compare with moving through the landscape of an unknown country and awakening from, this is where I want to be, moving. Thin woodlands, fields of sunflowers, crude industry, small squat houses. I feel tranquil, the train moves gently. The landscape opens like a flower and closes like a fist. I'm glad to be out of England, and this life of motion unrolls memories like a carpet. There's something pissing on the fantasy. The tall American with a mustache between Marlon Brando playing Zapata and Groucho Marx. And an accent which ranges from Texas through Kentucky to Brooklyn and back through Florida. We share the same sleeping compartment. As I stagger in, bleary-eyed, he is aware my bed had not been slept in. Did you get what you wanted last night, man? Oh, come on, man. You can tell me. A uniformed official comes in to check our tickets. Jesus Christ, he's the third one this morning. I think I've lost my chance of sleeping. U.S. grumbles. Everything in order, and we try to sleep. The door flies open, and the Contessa, looking bedraggled, falls in.
My bottle of brandy has been stolen.
She stares threateningly at the American.
Don't look at me, lady.
She glances my way for a moment.
Hello, darling. Why have you come back here?
She takes out a cigarette and says to the American, sitting on his bunk,
give me a leg.
He turns on his side and faces the wall.
I'm trying to get some sleep, lady.
Sleeped?
She hisses. He calls up to me. Can't you talk outside, man? I haven't said a word. Nevertheless, it is too crowded in the compartment, and it would be better with at least one less person in it. The Contessa stands and looms over his prostrate body.
So, you don't want to give me a light?
She is obviously still drunk. We had proved to be very good bottle pals. Now I have a great need to dream. I want to be left alone. The American stands and bumps his head. She moves aside while he, in pajama, reaches into his coat, which had fallen onto the floor. He takes out a box of matches and attempts to strike one. It falls apart. He tries another. It also falls apart. The Contessa mumbles something in German which defines her impatience and describes her disgust.
Hey, man, they're wet.
I sense panic in his voice.
So's my coat. And the floor.
He looks down at his bare feet, the toes of which were oozing amidst the tufts of damp carpet. In a short, swift leap, he lands on his bunk.
Jesus, man, you didn't piss there last night.
He appeals for reassurance, which he does not get.
Where's the water coming from?
I need a light,
said the Contessa, indicating incredible boredom of the situation. I am losing patience and don't want the compartment to stink of tobacco. It is also overcrowded. I say, I'll see you later. She turns her large, surprised eyes towards me. The mascara had run riot. The eyeshadow is over her ears. Her lipstick is smudged and she can't focus properly. As far as she is concerned, the party is only just beginning.
You may see me later, young man, in fact, as you will. But as for your companion, who cannot see with the blanched lady with an ordinary light for a simple cigarette, he will see me now. I do not wish to intrude where I am rebuilding, where the legs are damp and the floor is soggy.
As she rambled on, I felt the situation slipping out of control, like a moving car with the engine in neutral. U.S. croaks, for God's sake, lady. This is far from the peace and composure I've anticipated for the rest of the journey. As U.S. expostulates with the Contessa, she becomes engrossed in his mannerisms and senses his a weakness. His shifty eyes remind her of someone else. She narrows hers.
Do not bring the name of the Lord into your unwashed
that.
Look, lady, I like to clean and shave my teeth and sleep, if only you'd leave me alone.
She moved two steps towards him, and the water coming between her toes is audible. Lie back and close my eyes, expecting to hear.
I've got to skip over this sort of dream sentence.
God damn it!
The American says.
God damn it, woman, will you please leave the train?
The Contessa is in no mood for Yankee imperialist arguments.
No one can leave the train unless they are thrown, fall, or jump off. Which of these will be used in my departure?
I meant the compartment. I paid for it. For privacy.
Which currency did you hope to achieve that?
I paid in dollars.
She replies without hearing his answer.
I paid in dollars.
The coin has yet to be minted.
Because of the sad tone in her voice, I turn over and look down. She sits on his bunk and gives shelf room on her face to an encyclopedia of tragedies and a cosmetic manual cut up and served as a cubist clown. Her nose is a beacon of despair, and her swollen lips dance upon her chin. Each eye tells a lie of the other.
God damn it, woman,
the American says. The door flies open, and a sleeping car attendant comes in, speaking a fluent, overhung Russian. Lifting a cleft chin, he draws a thick finger across his torn throat. I shrug my shoulders apologetically. As he shakes his fist and starts laughing, backing out the door and leaving it open.
Will somebody close that goddamn door?
Shouts the American as two people wait by in the corridor outside. How about the corridor, you flooded man? I am no Oliver, so don't answer. Ivan reappears with a steel tray which he places on my bed. It contains steamed potatoes and beef. And just as I was about to express my gratitude, the Contessa screeches at him.
It must have been you! The bottle of brandy!
He orders her out, and she spits accusations. The venom and contempt comes out of her pores like sweat in a turbid bath. I am getting very hot, and the windows are steaming up. The potatoes are good, but very dry. I had to leave the compartment.
Thank God that war's over. Now maybe if you left, lady, I could get up and take a shave.
U.S. a smart victory. Before the Contessa can synchronize vision with hearing and speech motors, the door opens again, customs staggering slightly.
Gin doubly, hashish, whiskey, guns.
The Contessa cannot resist anything.
I will take the whiskey now, and have the rest later.
Please, open your baggage.
I am traveling light, but the Americans prepared for a blizzard, drought, food poisoning, famine, piles, and a coming out fall, and a third world war problem. Because of rumored shortages, he had arrived in England with a tea chest of toilet rolls, all the way from Slippery Rock, Massachusetts. The customs is a lot of studying to do, not much space to do it in. He is unaware of the damp floor which leaves US in a state of panic as he stoops to retrieve his shirt. Ivan comes into the compartment with an armed policeman and points at the Contessa. Was curled into a corner of the lower bunk, speaking rapid Russian at her, which she refuses to understand. U.S. is only dimly aware of anything except the customs man who says, "This day to be got up." "Present from an admirer," U.S. replies modestly.
"What do you intend to use it for?"
Snatches of their conversation are beginning to sound interrogatory. The Contessa is being stubborn.
"I am not leaving here until someone returns the bottle of brandy, darling. And the $300 which have also vanished. $500.
Customs leaves the Americans' clothes in a heap, squeezing past the Russian and policeman, stops for a short chat. U.S. seemed relieved.
That son of a bitch really gave me a going over. What the hell's happening now? Who are these guys?
Then, the policeman and Ivan both turned towards him.
Now look, you guys, she ain't nothing to do with me.
The policeman speaks a little English.
But she is sitting half naked on your back. I am, aren't I, darling? Do you find me attractive too?
She leans over and caresses US's leg.
Did you find the brandy, darling?
US looks shocked.
You must make the lady return to her own part of the train. You should not have brought her here.
The Contessa rises like a cobra. Oh, sorry, US protests.
I didn't bring her here.
The Contessa rises like a cobra.
Oh, so then you have made a plaything of me. You tore me aside.
US appeals to me. Will you tell him what happened, man? I'm getting very tired of all this. The policeman has no time for dubious witnesses and barely gives me more than a glance.
I think it would be better if you came along and answered some questions. Perhaps the lady wishes to make an official complaint.
The Contessa straightens her hair. She never refuses an invitation. US, pulling on his pants, says,
this is insane, man. Are you coming along?
No. As he leaves the compartment, his expression of injured self-righteousness is turning to panic. I give him the bowl of meat, close the door, take out my copy of The Third Policeman, and opening it between pages 91 and 92, snort the line of coke I packed into the tightly bound volume, a great book, and I hope to read it one day. Right, so the next episode, which I'm sure you're all dying to hear. Takes place in the in a hotel in Warsaw. And actually, only what it is a bunch of poets heading for a poetry, you know, and one of these stuff in national poetry. Dudes. So, having checked into my room, I went into the ornate. I didn't want, went into the ornate. I went down the ornate stairs with tall mirrors to the cocktail bar, where a number of friendly girls with heavy makeup were sitting close to a couple of Englishmen who were ignoring them. A round-faced Irishman with a beer drink in his belly was buying the girls drinks.
Hope the IRA can't fuck the English!
He was wearing one of the badges which had been given out by the organisers of the poetry festival. So by that and the magic of his tongue, I took him to be a brother in the fine art of gobshite. Hello there.
Hello, my old son, and who the fucking hell are you? Another English bastard come to spread your bankrupt culture and imperialism over the innocent sausage eating people this side of the span curtain. Can I buy you a drink? And they choke you for the many crimes your countrymen have committed on the bodies and souls of Ireland. What will it be?
I settled into a drink with the man, and he spoke a long, gorgeous poem.
No, let's hear one of your own, if you're not ashamed to speak it, and for decent ears to hear it.
I said to him my poem, The Devil Destroying the Angel, which immediately won me an Irish passport.
You know, the word Mara in your poem comes from the Irish Gaelic. What are you drinking, girl? Wouldn't you want to take a few of them home with you? Bless their vodka-eating livers. Here's to you, Geordie, and may the back wheels of your bicycle throw mud into the faces of your enemies forever. Drink up, girls, there's more where that came from.
We were joined by a silver-haired man in his late 60s and his shadow, a gaunt, middle-aged bloke who could have been a brokering salesman. He wore a brown suit with braggy trousers. Braggy trousers.
Are you boys here, Mr. Wendell?
For the first time, the Irishman was without words.
The poetry lark.
Though he recovered quickly.
What will you drink? Taffy. Brian's the name. I'll have a vodka, thank you very much. I'm not in the way of the lingo yet. The gentleman's buying around, Mr. Evans. The usual, is it? He's a bit there. Aren't you, Mr. Evans?
Mr. Evans looked annoyed.
I was just seeing Mr. Evans. You're a bit deaf.
Oh, I heard you, Brian. Don't shout.
Oh, it's working, is it? I'm never sure when he's plugged in. You see, wonderful chap. This is a whiskey with a touch of soda, isn't it, Mr. Evans?
There's no need to shout, Brian. I can hear.
All right, Mr. Evans. He's wonderful for his age, you know. Wonderful chap.
Brian leant over the counter and grabbed the barmaid's hand. Sorry, Brendan leant over the counter and grabbed the barmaid's hand.
Aren't you the beautiful girl with your hairy legs and all? My wife's got hairy legs just like yours. Two of them. No, will you be getting us all another drink? And one each for the girls over there, and a large one for yourself. A whiskey and soda for the handsome old gentleman, and a vodka for his umbrella stand. And would you ask those two pudding-faced bastards of English tractor salesmen what they'll be having?
At this point, the mustachioed American came in and leant over my shoulder. Aye. I guess you didn't expect to see me so soon, huh? Is someone buying the drinks?
Yak, your timing is perfect. And as you appear to be a friend of my friend here, what will you have?
Said Brendan. Whatever you've got, I mumbled to myself, we'll have it, short of the doors. The American, thinking he'd got one on, a simple paddy, congratulated himself by winking at me on a large brandy he'd asked for a ride. Turning his back on the Irishman, he addressed me out the corner of his mouth. I reckon I make a pretty good hustler. What do you think? He'd first given me the hump as the train set out from Victoria Station, and he began unwrapping his corned beef sandwiches and unfolding his plans for the visit. I'm really looking forward to this trip. My friend, who is the literary editor of Encounter, said he'd commission an article if the American could get anything out of the Polish ports. He brought a tape recorder along with him for the purpose. When he turned up in the barroom, I was surprised to see him. What's your room like, man? Mine's a pokey little hole at the back with a neat view of a brick wall, and not enough room to hang a cat.
Swing a cat, don't you mean, boyo?
You English can swing it, I'll hang it.
I'm not English, I'm Welsh. Have you met Mr. Evans, this distinguished historian and poet? Wonderful man. Easier to read too. Mr. Evans, say hello to the American. He's a little deaf.
Mr. Evans turned his back and was enjoying a quiet tete-a-tete with one of the friendly girls. He was not pleased to be drawn away. Don't shout, Brian, I've told you many times. Pleased to meet you, mister. Aye, Van Diemen's the name, poetry is the game. Evans shook his hand and returned to a subdued chat with the girl.
Wonderful man, wonderful for his age, you know, I was just seeing Mr. Evans.
By which time Mr. Evans had completely turned his back, so Brian continued his remarks to the American.
I'd do anything for him. That old man is like a father to me, great poet.
The American looked into the bottom of his empty glass but kept his hand away from his pocket. I just ain't heard of it. Brian, gazing at his own glass, which had just enough alcohol in it not to be called empty, said,
What? Oh, he's a very influential man in Wales. Comes from a very important family. Haven't you read his recent biography, Mr. Evans of Evanstown?
Still gazing into his empty glass, the American shuffled from one foot to another. Maybe I did. Say, who's buying the drinks? Brian was quick.
Not me, boyo. Last one in, I should think.
That's not how we do it in the States.
It happens all over the British Empire.
This is Poland. With the tapas telepathy, they drifted away from each other, but ended up on either side of the Irishman, who had by now emptied all his money onto the bar counter. And was stroking the side of his face with the back of the barmaid's hand. He lifted a heavy eyelid and gazed at them with a tear-swollen eye. So, how was the time going? How did you feel? What time? Oh, there was a request. Do you want to go home now? Or do you want to have another one?
She will finish off with this other one, which is the epilogue to this collection, which is called Custom and Exile.
It's lovely for the publisher. I wrote playing 30 dirty songs in search of an opera. I'm also writing another one called Waiting for Gyro by Samuel Bucket. So, this is the Nash, right, which is, I'll say, it shows you how old it is. And the Nash was a National Assistance Board Office, of course. But now it's the SS, no problem. And this is at Helen's request. Thinking to save myself a double journey, I telephoned Melton Street near Euston Station Social Security Office. So this finishes up his book anyway, it sort of goes where he's travelled. There's a whole lot of stories taking place in Newcastle and various parts of the North East. You know, sort of young minister bought through the sort of unemployment and sort of, you know, office of savage butchery of these sort of underprivileged of the 20th century. And does all that business in Poland, ends up back in England. Thinking to save myself, I like it, and this is like an extra on the diary. Thinking to save myself a double journey is the fourth time I've started that. I telephone the Mountain Street near Euston Station Social Security Office. They tell me there are no appointments left this week. I explain it's in an emergency, and the officer says, come in and see reception. They might have some appointments left. I tear my number ticket from the machine and take a seat. A girl, swollen, exposed belly, no more than 20, staggers around the room, occasionally breaking with a manic giggle. She could be on downers, a junk, a number of old people who'd been waiting a long time without being seen. An emaciated woman of about 50 gives a junkie a cigarette, then attacks her in a vicious Cockney accent.
You shouldn't be here! You shouldn't be here! I've seen their faces, sniggering. Come off the park this morning, pet. I saw you. I'm not blind. You shouldn't be here, though.
The junkie turns around to face the rest of us, mimics her. You shouldn't be here. You shouldn't be here. You shouldn't be here. At which an ugly man with one arm and a dirty sling goes and leans over her. Did you say something? He sounds menacing. She looks at him blankly with her eyes. Were you saying we shouldn't be here? While he interrogates the junkie girl, his woman, with a classic on the batter face going sensually to seed, leers with a proud, red, smudged grin at the rest of us. The wait is interminable in the rapidly filling room. Only one official on duty processing the inquiry, an Indian woman with her son, a few more pensioners, and a smart young woman in a cream-coloured trouser suit, patting her black hair nervously into place. She glances sideways at the young men who watch her, unsuccessfully attempt to cue jump, failing to catch the attention of the occasional official, who strolls apparently aimlessly behind the thick perspex screen which divides them from us. Some clients try one way or another to indicate through a gesture or grimace the way they walk in or sit down that they are here by accident. They may even slip off the impression that they are on official rather than personal business. Others speak in familiar tones of barely concealed despair. The emaciated Cockney woman in a blue flowered dress lectures anyone whose eyes she can catch about the junkie.
I tell them, that'll keep her face shut. I used to work there too, in the hotel. There's a Polish cook there.
She turns to the junkie girl and makes her more angry by giggling.
What was the soup, girl? Salt and water? In your milk bottle, was it? Did they hurt ya?
The girl replies in a quiet voice. There were three of them.
How long ago was it? Christmas? You read, eh? Yeah, with my bloody hen. I saw you coming out of the park this morning. Is that where you're living? Because you shouldn't be here. Your head!
She turns her attention to the others.
That'll shut her fucking face up. The bitch. I know, yeah. Look what it did to my fucking hand!
She thrusts the previously concealed and bloody mangled paw in her face. My number comes up and I take a seat in front of the official. We're divided by a thick perspex wall which reaches to the ceiling. When he takes my particulars, the Cockney lady tells the junkie girl to hang on to the packet of cigarettes she'd given her,
You'll need them. They'll see you through for a while, though. The official tells me he has no spare interviews for another 4 days. But why couldn't that have been arranged by a telephone? We haven't any interviews left which can be arranged by telephone. We're lucky to get the one arranged for Friday. But I've got no money. But we can't help you until you get interviewed. Someone else's number comes up, and as I lean, the young jumpy trousers start falling down, exposing a dark, wiry pubic hairs. A few men are amused, the pensioners are embarrassed, and the women with children bristle with frustrated anger. Right, thank you.